are getting me down. Oh, escape those dreary 20th century blues.
Oh. Welcome to the seventh episode in the series Talking Modernism, the podcast about the 1920s and 30s and how grandparents and great-grandparents changed the world. I'm your host, Michael Hauptmann. This episode is the second and final discussing the districts of Tel Aviv known as the White City. In the previous episode, I gave you a very brief overview of Zionism, the founding of Tel Aviv, and the roots of functionalist architecture. Let's continue by exploring why Tel Aviv was so receptive to this radical new style of architecture. The creation of the White City. Functionalist, or international style architecture as it's also called, took root and flourished in 1930s Tel Aviv to an alignment of a whole number of factors that were unique to that time and that place. The first factor was the spirit of progress at large amongst the Yishuv, as the Jewish community in Palestine was called. Despite all the terrible and severe economic and political storms of the 1930s, it was nonetheless a more optimistic, less cynical time than today in many ways, as people still had a faith in progress, that modernism and the machine age would deliver a better tomorrow, and I discussed this in episode 4. And the Yishuv, the Jews in Palestine, were in many ways more optimistic and receptive to change than most. Recall that I described in the first episode the early Zionist pioneers as being borderline revolutionaries, very open to new ways of thinking and new ways of doing. And so we shouldn't be too surprised to discover that international style architecture was introduced to Palestine not by the recent immigrants from Germany in the Fifth Aliyah after 1929, but rather by forward-thinking architects who had arrived in Palestine in earlier waves. Consider, for instance, the four architects who in 1932 formed the Tel Aviv Chug, or Circle, in order to popularise the international style in Tel Aviv. All four immigrated to Palestine in the 1920s and then returned to Europe to practice, and there they learnt the international style from the originators. Aryeh Sharon trained at the Bauhaus School under Hannes Meyer. Joseph Neufeld worked in Berlin for Eric Mendelssohn and also worked with Bruno Taut in Moscow. Zev Rechter worked with Le Corbusier. Tel Avivians saw themselves as not just creating a Jewish city, but a city modern in every sense of the world, and the international style suited them perfectly. Another reason that the international style found popularity was that it was indeed international, or at least it didn't match any national style. In fact, this lack of historicism, or reference to the German architectural vernacular, was the reason that the Nazis hated the international style. But given that Jewish Palestinians wanted to cast off their former nationalities, Russian, Romanian, German, and form a new common Zionist identity, it was precisely this lack of reference to a specific nationality in the international style that appealed. And the fact that Nazis hated it was probably icing on the cake. And yet another reason that the style was popular, that it was often cheap and quick to build through the use of concrete. And this was a vital consideration given the population explosion occurring in Tel Aviv in the 1930s. Large-scale use of concrete as a building material began before World War I, with buildings like the Théâtre des Champs-Élysées in Paris. Germany in particular had completed a number of large-scale public housing developments in the 1920s using concrete, such as the Neuss Frankfurt program, which built 12,000 apartments in the 5 years between 1925 and 1930, under the direction of architect Bruno Taut. The Neuss Frankfurt program had used pre-cast concrete elements, and this differed from Tel Aviv's building, which were built from concrete blocks with limestone render. This method of construction did not require large amounts of skill, and this was important as the continuing tensions with Arabs in Jaffa meant that this traditional source of skilled building labourers was cut off, with Arab boycotts of Jewish businesses. In response, the Yishuv adopted a policy of Hebrew labour, Avodah Ivrit. A silicate brick production company was established in 1922, and a cement company was established the following year. Concrete block construction suited unskilled labour available in the latest wave of immigrants. Poetry at the time describes medical students and lawyers learning to mix cement. Furthermore, concrete construction had favourable connotations of modern and up-to-date, in line with the Yishuv's perception of themselves. The then High Commissioner John Chancellor wrote in 1929, "By reason of their greater intelligence and manual skill, the Jews are economically superior to the Arabs in some of the more modern forms of skilled and semi-skilled work, such as reinforced concrete, care of machinery, and electrical work." In 1934, Tel Aviv hosted the Levant Fair, an international expo to showcase the industries of Jewish Palestine to the world. The fair was a huge success, 600,000 visitors and pavilions from 30 countries. A permanent exhibition complex covering 10 hectares was built on the seaside, with pavilions designed by local architects, all in the white box international style. Tel Avivians were very proud of the fair, designed and built in Palestine in time and no doubt on budget, and this helped position the international style as Tel Aviv's own. So, after that rather long preamble, let's examine some of the White City buildings that are still available to the visitor today. Buildings of the White City. In the centre of Tel Aviv today, the 1930s international style still dominates. There's a Bauhaus Museum and Visitors Centre and a one-hour tour available of some of the key buildings. There's a huge number of functionalist buildings in the White City, 1,200 of an original 4,000. So I've selected just a couple to illustrate some of the principal aspects of the prevailing style. Engelhausen, I've provided a link on the website, is one of the most prominent examples of White City architecture. It's a low-rise apartment block, by far the most common building type in the White City. In Hebrew, an apartment block like this is called Beit Meshutaf, or communal house. Built by speculative builders, these buildings are made of reinforced concrete skeleton of columns and slabs, with the walls hollow concrete blocks 20 centimetres on the exterior and 5 to 7 centimetres on the interior. Exterior walls were rendered in limestone plaster, white, hence the White City. The floors were finished in terrazzo tiles. Windows were wood or steel. Each floor had 3 to 4 units arranged around a centre of stairwell with access to the roof. Units in the White City typically consisted of 2 or 3 multi-purpose rooms, as well as a small kitchen and bathroom, and always a balcony. These provided an essential escape as the uninsulated apartments became unbearably hot in that age before air conditioning. Engelhaus was built in 1933 by Ze'ev Rechter, one of the Tel Aviv Chug, the circle, 4 leading architects who were popularising the international functionalist style in Tel Aviv. It was the first building in Tel Aviv to be built on thin columns, pilotis, one of Corbusier's 5 principles. It also had a roof terrace, which was another of Corbusier's principles. These 2 features allowed a gradual transition between the public space of the street and the private space of the apartment. The roof terrace was a semi-private shared space for the residents. Functional architecture placed a great emphasis on social and communal spaces, which the Hoek Circle had to adapt to the realities of the Getty's plan for Tel Aviv with its 570 square metre blocks. Engel House is unusual in having long ribbon windows, another of Corbusier's 5 points. But this was impractical given the strength of Tel Aviv's sun and also the cost of windows in Palestine. They all had to be imported. Finally, part of the attraction of the ribbon window was to admire the view, and the views from these apartment blocks cheek by jowl on the Getty's plan wasn't great. Also on the podcast website, I've provided a link to Rubinsky House, which is perhaps more typical of the majority of White City apartment blocks. Rubinsky House sits on the ground rather than on thin column pilotis. And rather than having ribbon windows, it achieves a ribbon effect by having a recessed balcony on the south aspect. The thin concrete skin of the building is essentially a double wall around the balcony, which serves as a gradual transition space between the private apartment and the public street. The urban centre of the White City, and indeed Tel Aviv, is Dizengoff Square. There were a few prominent women architects in Palestine at the time, including the designer of Dizengoff Square, Jenia Averbuch. She also designed the Esther Cinema, one of a harmonious row of buildings curving around circular Dizengoff Square, united by the long horizontals of the recessed balconies. The scale of the White City was unique, and constructions like Dizengoff Square realized modernist concepts that otherwise were only paper sketches. And we can see this in Mie van der Rohe's 1927 proposal for a remodeling of Berlin's Alexanderplatz, a circular island very similar to Dizengoff. Averbuch had an interesting career. She was prominent in the Levant Fair, helping design the cafe there. She then helped design the diorama for the famous Futurama exhibition at New York's 1939 World Fair. Most of White City's accommodation were small-scale apartment blocks, but there were a handful of larger-scale cooperative worker estates sponsored by the Histadrut trade union movement. In particular, one on Frischmann Street designed by Ariel Sharon, another prominent member of the Tel Aviv Hug. Here, a large common space for the residents in the form of a large central yard is accessed from the street by a section on raised pilotis. Rediscovery and conservation. Unfortunately, the White City buildings fell into disrepair in the 60s, 70s and 80s. Tel Aviv's population moved to the more modern and spacious accommodation in the new suburbs. The White City apartments were often rent-controlled, so there was no incentive to renovate. And the white boxes did not age well. White render stained, balconies and void spaces were filled in, air conditioners stuck on. Even lovely Dizengoff Square was butchered to provide an underpass. The trigger for the White City's rebirth was basically a wave of nostalgia amongst Israeli Jews with a European background for the good old days. And this was triggered by the election in 1977 of Menachem Begin's Likud government. This marked the end of power for the leftist Labour government that had governed Israel since 1948, and in Israel this is referred to as the revolution. Now, it's not too much of a simplification to say that Labour was the party favoured by Israeli Jews of a European background who had built the White City, and Likud was the party of Middle Eastern Jews who had arrived in Israel after 1948. Taste changed with the change of government, and Likud's Build Your Own Home program resulted in a rash of aesthetically challenged McMansions. So in the 1980s, the grungy inner-city Tel Avivians began to look at the white city architecture with a new appreciation, and gradually an enthusiasm for conservation and restoration took hold. In 1984, there was a very influential exhibition at Tel Aviv's Museum of Art, and then in 1994, a symposium of Bauhaus in Tel Aviv, even though Bauhaus actually didn't have much to do with the White City. Finally, the Tel Aviv Council appointed Nitza Schmuck, who then conducted a survey of the remaining 1930s building, which then led to a conservation plan designating over 1,000 buildings against much opposition. Finally, in 2003, Tel Aviv's White City achieved UNESCO status on the World Heritage Register. Extensive funding was given for the renovations of buildings. Also, the council allowed owners to add an extra half story to the buildings with setbacks to minimize visual impact for the street, so long as they restored the rest of the building to the original condition. This scheme was not without its critics, but when you see the many renovated buildings, it does seem to me that they've achieved a reasonable compromise. Behind the official narrative, the Black City of Jaffa. Now, everything I've told you so far I believe to be factual and true, and it is the narrative you will hear when you visit the White City Visitors Centre today. But if you feel the story sounds a bit too good to be the whole truth, from the froth of a wave on the cloud, I built myself a white city, stormy, fluid, beautiful, in the words of a 1960 poem by Naomi Schmer, there are indeed further facts and perspectives. I can recommend the book Black City, White City by Sharon Rothbard, an Israeli architect and historian, where he largely convincingly and certainly passionately challenges the White City narrative. Here are a couple of his points. The first is that Tel Aviv has created the White City as its old city centre. But that ignores or at least minimises the infinitely older Jaffa just to the south. And whilst the White City has been maintained and restored, a large part of Jaffa has been destroyed and remodelled as part of effort to suppress rebellion by its Arab inhabitants, first by the British Army in 1936 and later by the Israelis. Rothbard also notes that the boundaries of the White City are somewhat arbitrary and ignores many of the modernist buildings that were built in Arab townships of Jaffa like Manshieh, sometimes by Arab architects. 1930s architecture in Jaffa itself followed a more decorative Art Deco tradition, as seen by the lovely Alhambra Cinema, which is still standing, but sadly most of these buildings have been lost. And Rothbard notes that the White City mirrors the large international-style projects that were built by colonial powers for colonialists. Algeria, Dakar, or the Art Deco buildings of Eritrea built by the colonising fascist Italian government. The style was attractive to colonialists not only because it was new and exciting and spoke of the future, but because it lacked any stylistic reference to the country that they were in. Similarly, Tel Aviv's White City ignored any reference to anything local or Arabic. It claimed to be international, but it was essentially Western. Eric Mendelssohn's alternative modernism. Also working in Palestine in the 1930s was one very prominent architect who pursued a style of modern architecture very different from the functionalism of Tel Aviv's White City, Eric Mendelssohn. Although his works are limited, elitist work for a much more affluent clientele than that of the White City, his buildings do suggest an intriguing what-if alternative to the architecture and politics of Tel Aviv's Hug. And if you're interested in finding out more, I can recommend Seizing Jerusalem, The Architectures of Unilateral Unification, published in 2017 by Alana Nitzam-Shiften, Professor of Architecture at Haifa's Technion University. His work does suggest an intriguing what-if alternative to the architecture and politics of the Tel Aviv Chug. Unlike Ariel Sharon and other members of the Tel Aviv Chug, Eric Mendelssohn was a citizen of Germany rather than Palestine. Furthermore, he had already achieved international renown as one of the leading architects of the Expressionist architecture movement. Expressionism was an avant-garde art movement that was popular in Germany up until the late 1920s. A romantic movement, in many ways, Expressionism was the polar opposite of functionalism that inspired the White City. Though in truth, functionalism developed from Expressionism, and the two movements shared many stylistic similarities. Seeking to appeal to the heart rather than the head, Expressionism conceived of architecture as a work of art rather than a rational design exercise. Expressionist architecture was part of the avant-garde artistic movement that spurred the 1913 ballet The Rite of Spring that I discussed in Episode 3. Indeed, the radical Théâtre des Champs-Élysées, where the ballet premiered, was part designed by a leading Expressionist architect, Henry van der Velde. In 1924, Eric Mendelssohn leapt to prominence when he built the hallucinogenic Einstein's Tower in Berlin, both futuristic and organic, one of the key buildings of the Expressionist architecture movement. Luckily, it's still standing, and I've included a link on the podcast website. Seeking to express the speed and motion of the modern city, he then developed a style of commercial building emphasizing long horizontal bands of window, which evolved into the wonderful 1930s style known as Streamline Moderne. A wonderfully evocative style I'd like to explore further in a future episode. Mendelssohn, being Jewish, had to abandon his thriving German practice with the Nazi takeover in 1933 and then spent his time between Britain and Palestine. In Palestine, he built a number of very significant buildings, in particular major hospitals in Haifa and Jerusalem, and most notably a grand estate in Rehovot for Chaim Weizmann, who would become the first president of the new State of Israel. Like the architects of Tel Aviv Chug, Mendelssohn was both Zionist in conviction and modernist in style. But philosophically, Mendelssohn and the Chug were polar opposites. Whereas the Zionist aspiration of the Chug was to form a Jewish state, Mendelssohn represented a strand of Zionism that imagined a future Semitic commonwealth encompassing both Arabs and Jews. In a rather ill-timed pamphlet called Palestine and the World of Tomorrow, published in 1940, shortly before a disillusioned Mendelssohn left Palestine forever, he wrote, "The Balfour Declaration is a gift that can only be seen as two-edged. Two-edged because it induced the Jewish people to think of a state of their own, the lesser goal given by the grace of Versailles, the Treaty of Versailles, and deviating from the major goal, to become an equal member of the Semitic Commonwealth of Nations." And in architecture, Mendelssohn sought to achieve a new architecture specifically suited to this new Semitic Commonwealth, combining inspirations from the local vernacular architecture with the expressionist base that looked to the future. He resisted the international claims of functional architecture of the White City. As early as 1923, he had lectured on the new style of Bauhaus. To call this new conformity simply international is more verbal indolence than an expression of conviction. On the other hand, in such politically tense times, it appears almost frivolous to impute any kind of congenial relationships between individual countries. Ironic that the term internationality appears in history of nations only when their structural bonds are destroyed, and indicates the urgent need for a new, original way of thinking. Appealing as it may sound to post-colonial ears, at its core, though, Mendelssohn's congenial exoticism was just another aspect of colonialism. Whereas the Zionists of Tel Aviv's White City declared the European Jews separate from their Arab neighbours with the international architecture of the White City, Mendelssohn and his vision of a Semitic commonwealth claimed a kinship with the neighbouring Arabs that simply did not exist. After the declaration of the State of Israel in 1948, most Arab states immediately expelled all their Jewish citizens, regardless of their sympathies or otherwise, with the new Zionist nation. It is only today that some Arab nations are beginning to encourage the return of Jewish communities. And so we come to the end of the episode. I hope you found it interesting and perhaps even inspire you to visit Tel Aviv for yourself. It's one of the world's great cities, and the White City is only part of its charm. Join me next time when I'll talk about the Paris exhibition of 1925, which sparked the explosion of the gorgeous style known as Art Deco. I look forward to speaking to you then.